Welcome to Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. Your host is Tucker Perkins, engineer, entrepreneur, business leader, speaker, and clean energy industry veteran, who now serves as president and CEO of the Propane Education and Research Council. Now, here's Tucker.
Welcome to episode 17 of The Path to Zero. I'm your host, Tucker Perkins. With a new year and a new administration, there's no doubt we'll see a major shift in the climate and energy landscape. In this episode, I'm fortunate to talk to a journalist and podcast host who has some amazing perspective on climate policy and just what we can expect with the changes in Washington. Julia Piper wears a lot of hats. She's a contributing editor at Green Tech, covering the clean energy movement, and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, an international affairs think tank. I'm also excited to talk to Julia about her own podcast, Political Climate, which bills itself as an inside-the-trenches view on just how energy and climate decisions get made and the political interests that power them. Julia, what a pleasure it is to welcome you to Path to Zero.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Fun to be on another podcast.
We're glad to have you. Let's get straight to your own podcast, Political Climate. You boldly state that it's a bipartisan podcast on energy and environmental issues. Talk to us about what makes that show bipartisan and why is that even important to you?
Yeah, well, I'm a Canadian, and so I try to be the peacemaker on this show. I've lived in the United States now for a decade and love the politics and love the country, and I'm a total political junkie. And of course, after covering the energy and environment space, you do often come back to the politics of the day. And so I happened to meet through my reporting two great experts in this space, Brandon Hurlbut, a former chief of staff of the Department of Energy under Secretary Stephen Chu, so in the Obama administration. He's our Democrat. And Shane Skelton is our Republican, and he was an energy advisor to former House Speaker Paul Ryan and has worked at other energy industry trade groups, et cetera. And, you know, he's a Republican, as I mentioned, and we just honestly got along. We all lived in the Los Angeles area, had sort of met each other through various connections and wanted to do something that would speak to the moment. And by that, I mean, speak to the echo chambers that we felt were developing and try to find a fun and engaging way to reach across them, to see where there were areas of commonality and have some fun along the way, which I think we kind of do. And we were lucky enough to get some supporting from the University of Southern California's Schwarzenegger Institute. You know, Arnold Schwarzenegger is a Republican. He has not given up that affiliation and really believes strongly in trying to find unity in the country. So it was a really great affiliation for us. And, you know, we're not here to pretend like there aren't challenges politically in the world right now. Like, we want to acknowledge that. We acknowledge also that climate change is real. There is no debate around the science. We do discuss, though, what political talking points are coming to the top, where we're seeing policies work, what is proving controversial, what are the messages that are resonating with Americans today. So we feel like there's still a lot of space to have those conversations in a respectful and fruitful way, even if we don't always agree.
That's really interesting. Hey, talk to us a little bit about Governor Schwarzenegger. I've had a chance to bump into him a couple times. We have a lot of his staff, actually former staff, that intersects with us quite a bit. How involved is he today with the Institute and with climate policy?
Yeah, well, recognizing that we are sort of an affiliate of him, of his, you know, I don't speak for the governor, but you can follow his work. I mean, through the Institute, they've really put a focus on environmentalism, and that often expresses itself in the form of working on electrification of transportation. Arnold Schwarzenegger has teamed up with a group called Veloz that's working to advance EVs, and he did a really fun campaign called Kicking Gas. So they're involved on that front. But also a big thing they did this year was give out these democracy grants. And this is a larger thing that they're doing to try and help facilitate free and fair elections. So Arnold Schwarzenegger gave out these grants to help poll workers basically do their jobs, make sure that they had the resources that they needed to execute on the election well. So I would say that he is staying very involved in these few areas around free, fair elections, environmentalism, and justice, and racial justice and environmental justice kind of stem from that too.
I had a chance to see him not very long ago, and he certainly hasn't lost his time in the weight room. He's still staying in great shape. He is still the Terminator, but for sure. So neat guy. Hey, you talked to some other great people on your podcast. I had a chance to listen to your interview with Neil Chatterjee, I guess how you say that, the FERC commissioner, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. I think if I remember right, he's a Trump appointee, was a former aide to Mitch McConnell. And of course, FERC, I might argue, is the most powerful agency shaping energy policy today, at least. How do you see the political makeup of FERC moving forward working with Biden?
Yeah, so as I understand it, there's now five members of FERC, which there wasn't for a long time. They were kind of understaffed on that front. But the Trump administration just did confirm two new commissioners. So that brings us to three Republicans and two Democrats, with Neil Chatterjee being one of those Republicans who, you know, it's such an interesting story because when you come at this from the outside, he was a staffer for Mitch McConnell, Senator McConnell, and he was dubbed a coal guy when he took this role at FERC. And the environmental community was really worried about what Neil Chatterjee would do in that role. Ultimately, you know, he became chairman, although he was recently removed from that role and I think a bit of a political shuffle. He shepherded and led through a really major rulemaking around distributed energy resources and allowing distributed renewables to potentially play in these regional electricity markets. And he also opened a dialogue on carbon pricing. So here you had this coal guy or someone people thought of as a coal guy come in and really shift the portfolio at FERC. And he admits on our podcast, you know, he came in with a partisan lens and really took the weight of the office of being a principal once he got to FERC very seriously and realized that he had a very different role to play. And he really like worked with the industry players, including, as he jokes, the environmentalists in the oil industry, and heard from them that they wanted carbon pricing. So that really informed his decision making. So yeah, a fascinating guy. And so my point there is, I think that you asked about the makeup, three Republicans, two Democrats. I think strip away the political affiliations, it seems like now there's a majority on FERC who are really interested in progressing energy policy in new ways that hasn't been seen before. So I think Neil Chatterjee will be a key vote in that until his term is up in mid-2021.
Great. Yeah, and exciting. They've had some exciting rulings just in the last month or so. So look forward to seeing more of that. Mm-hmm. Has anyone that you've interviewed on political climate really either been particularly exciting to you or maybe more importantly to me, surprised you with their views?
Yeah, oh, man, there's been so many cool interviews over time. We did have a chance to meet Greta Thunberg, the youth climate activist in Vienna one year. That was kind of fun. Of course, I mentioned Neil Chatterjee. We've had people across the political spectrum. I think one that was actually not a very political related interview was Tony Seba, who is a futurist. And he predicted several years ago the pace and acceleration of renewable energy and the decline in costs, also around electric vehicles. And some of his predictions have been right on. And so people called him crazy at the time. People still call him kind of crazy for being way too bullish on the future of new technologies. But he has been right on a number of things. And he has a new book that came out that we discussed. And he says things like, you know, nation states, like that's an antiquated concept. Like it's going to be regions that accelerate. And I really tried to push him on that and figure out what does that really mean? Like, so China wouldn't be the new leader? He says, no, central governments cannot lead in ways that we need them to. It's going to be a distributed revolution. He also says that generally incumbents, both countries and companies, if they don't adapt, they're going to be like Rome and fall by the wayside. And he really paints this in stark terms, how the mixing of political transformation and technological revolution is going to come together in a way that will fundamentally disrupt our society. And it will either create an age of freedom, as he calls it, or potentially some real disruption and negative outcomes. So I encourage people to listen to that episode. It'll challenge some of your ways of thinking.
Yeah, does he worry at all about the intermittency of a renewable system? And I went back this week and was reviewing kind of exactly how California had gotten into the issue they had gotten through in that last little heat wave. And I mean, really at the end of the day, it was about a lot of heat and just an inability to handle, you know, those big demands when power was not quite available. Did he talk at all about intermittency of the renewable system?
he kind of looks beyond that. I think there's a lot of work, as we know, people who work in this sector day to day, I cover the news day to day, that there's tons being done to make new resources come online, to make sure the grid is working day to day, minute by minute, second by second. But I think Tony Siva's point is like, all that will work out. What we're seeing is even faster development of technologies that will make all of this easy one day. Sensors on the grid that let you know what is happening second by second. That technology is now coming online and becoming cheap enough that it will really change the way we run the power grid in this scenario. So yes, a lot of work to do to get there, but the technology is now reaching a tipping point, he would say, that we're going to solve all those issues.
Yeah, I think one of the things I definitely see is that innovation, really innovation beyond what we even can envision today, is probably going to be the answer. I mean, I firmly believe that lithium, whatever the solutions are around EV, and even for that matter, storage, it's probably not going to involve lithium. It's going to involve some battery type storage we haven't even thought about yet. I know we're seeing innovation, even, you know, on our side of clean, low carbon fuels. Our innovation is, we'll announce in the next weeks, a partnership with a major engine manufacturer, and that engine is 25% cleaner than the next cleanest technology.
Right.
So innovation's exciting.
Yeah. I mean, my brother works in tractors. I grew up in a rural area of Ontario. And even in the tractor sector, they're seeing innovation, right? Like, we need those big, powerful machines there, but they are implementing new technology all the time that is part of a climate solution, even though maybe a climate activist wouldn't think of that as part of a solution. It is one piece of it, because we do need those machines to do certain things, and we don't have a full-scale new option yet. So these incremental changes can make big differences.
And I think that's the place where I love to intersect, is the nation seems to be so reluctant to move away from diesel. We're so dependent on diesel. It's been, you know, such a workhorse for us for 100 years, but it really is a dirty fuel, dirty to use, dirty to store. Tractors are a great example. And so we really work on that hardworking engine that probably is not ready for EV, but certainly is ready for some cleaner solution. So, man, so much fun in that. Julia, we're going to head into a break. And when we come back, I'd like to talk to you about the new President's Energy and Environmental Team, which includes some familiar names, as well as your thoughts on how Biden is going to bridge the clean energy political divide. We'll be back in just a minute.
Zero is a big number. Getting close to a future of zero emissions starts with using the broadest mix of clean, low-carbon energy sources. You might be surprised to know that propane produces a lot of energy for thousands of purposes and millions of people with virtually zero particulate matter, zero impact to the ozone, zero toxicity, and zero potential for storage-related contamination. It's low NOx and low CO2 to boot. Path to Zero is sponsored by Propane, Clean American Energy. Learn more at cleanamericanenergy.us.
My guest on this episode of Path to Zero is Julia Piper, contributing editor at GreenTech and host of the Political Climate podcast. Okay, Julia, we now know who the main players will be on climate, energy, and the Biden administration. Former Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm as Energy Secretary, North Carolina environmental official Michael Regan to head the EPA. A new position has been created for John Kerry. He's the special presidential envoy for climate. And then former EPA chief Jenna McCarthy, she will be the new White House climate czar. You've talked to some of these people on your podcast. And what are your thoughts on the team Biden has put together?
Yeah, I mean, it does seem like the Biden administration is optimizing for experience and diversity, which I think they've kind of hit some of the marks on. They've kind of thread the needle there, I think, in getting both some old guard names that say the leading edge of their party, the progressives, would not love, but then and then balancing that with some new faces, bringing some diversity in. So another name is Deb Haaland, Representative Deb Haaland, who's now named as Secretary of the Interior. She's the first Native American cabinet member and first Secretary of the Interior to be Native American. And that speaks volumes, I think. Also, as a little side note, I just realized that around a quarter of the US emissions come from federal lands, fossil fuel production on federal lands. So what happens there, whether it's carbon capture sequestration technology or diversification, you know, the federal lands really do play a major role in what happens in decarbonization. So I think that's another important name to think about. But again, overall, you see people who've been fighting for justice for a long time, now in positions of power, would they get to craft the policies to, I think, see their mission come to fruition.
So that's a fascinating topic that I wrestle with just about every week now, is justice, because it certainly is important. And I would argue, I think in our case, often propane is the fuel of choice for people who live a little closer to the poverty line. It often is the fuel they use to cook their food and heat their home, heat their water. How do you think this new administration squares justice with perhaps imposing, you know, as they see on their environment for clean, certainly costs have to rise? Do you hear them talk much about that?
Well, it depends on what kind of cost. I mean, to challenge some of the assumptions, I mean, renewable energy prices, again, it depends on whether we're talking about power in the electricity sector or transportation, because they are different, because they're different ecosystems and different markets and supply demand impacts. But renewable energy, for instance, is sometimes the cheapest resource. We are seeing utilities move away from coal, not just because of some environmental mission. This happened under the Trump administration, that they moved away from coal because alternatives were cheaper. So I think there's something to be said there. And then there's also other costs that are hidden, right? What is a true cost of a resource? And resilience should be something that's factored in. To your point about California, how do you make sure that your resources are working in a way that keeps your grid operating? And what price is that? What is that worth to you? But also local pollution. What are the health costs of various resources? And are we properly pricing that in? So I think it's not an answer to your question, but I do think that the Biden administration is going to have a lot more research and study around the true metrics here and embed a really scientific approach to all this, that we could see the cost discussion become both more complex, but perhaps more honest about what each resource really means and does.
Yeah. Yeah, we're really excited to be a part of a conversation that really, as I call the trio, one, climate, so really mainly focused on greenhouse gases, health, so we talk about particulate matter and ozone and NOx and SOx and all those things that impact our health, whether it's plant health or human health, and then really justice, you know, how do you pay for it? And I find a lot of the guests I have seem to think, you know, one of the guests said, it's just all baked in. And I as a taxpayer, I wonder if that's really possibly true, is that, yeah, it is all, it's a complex ecosystem of health and doctor's bills and climate effects. I'm not sure it's all baked in. So clearly he's got, I love to see this group coming together. And I think, as you said, they have a unique blend of experiences. I don't be real in, interesting. I'm curious in your viewpoint on kind of, clearly there's a battle inside his group, right? There are the progressives that want immediate radical change today. And then there are some moderates that would probably love a status quo, if that's the right word, for moderate incremental change. I think he's got a tough balancing act in the middle there somewhere.
I don't know. Maybe maybe I'm looking through rose-colored glasses. You know, we're speaking at the end of the year. Everyone likes to feel good coming to the conclusion. But I actually feel like there's more agreement even across the political aisle than we talk about. You know, the Democrats in the House, who are considered the old guard, put forward a net zero by 2050 policy. That's not exactly, you know, slow moving. A lot has to happen. In fact, there's new modeling out of Princeton just this week that shows exactly what would have to happen to achieve a goal like that. So if that's considered the moderate solution, I think we're in, you know, we're moving pretty quick here. Something like a Green New Deal would then be the progressive one, which just adds on a different approach, I would say, around the level of government spending versus using free market tools. But I think on the Democrat side, there's a lot of action, although there's not 100% alignment. But even then, on the Republican side, you are seeing the Senate, as we speak right now, incorporate some energy innovation technology into the budget talks, recognizing the situation evolves very quickly. But you see Lisa Murkowski and Joe Manchin coming together and actually forwarding some real decarbonization policies. So again, when you strip out some of the political language at the highest levels, I actually feel like there's more agreement than we think. And even Republican communities, like, they want to see jobs in their neighborhoods. And if that comes from solar, they don't usually care if they get the jobs. But you know, need to make, but we do need to make sure that these solutions work for everyone. They're affordable for everyone, to your point. So there's that. I think my last point on that is that I think we are seeing an expanded discussion just since the election, when people split their tickets and we saw that there's a, you know, Democrat at the top, but we'll see what happens in the Senate. But even in the House, you know, the Democrats lost some seats. It kind of showed that the country is ready for change, but maybe not wholesale change. And so in energy, I feel like that is translating to a more of a, I guess, to steal an old line, an all the and above approach. People are still talking about various pathways to decarbonization, maybe propane, but carbon capture sequestration, renewables, energy storage, various kinds of energy storage. And this is now happening across the board, that at least now we're seeing a decarbonization agenda, I think, be adopted in a more mainstream way. We're just also now talking about a lot more resources to get there, and that's probably a good thing.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, one of the things we could completely agree with people is that, you know, the path to zero is important. I mean, it's one reason we call this podcast Path to Zero. And the other is it's probably best achieved through a wider path, right? Not one fuel. I mean, because then again, there's all the issues around resilience that you talked about earlier. They've just gone away, right? So it's about how can you achieve that goal using as many options as available? Because then you have choice.
Yeah, and so, I think the key thing there too is that it's the choice of the local constituents, because I think that is a key thing. Are we making sure that the resource is serving the needs of each area? Because in the U.S., you know, communities are different. You know, different resources are available to them. The grids work differently. The weather is different. The communities maybe want different things. If a community wants to go 100% renewable, that is technologically feasible. If they want to, you know, make the other necessary investments to do that, that is within their right to do so. But if other communities maybe want to keep costs lower or, you know, whatever, I think also bringing in local solutions is a key thing to making these things stick.
Yeah. One of the things that struck me this week is people are kind of wrapping up year in. We're looking at data. We're beginning to have a lot more focus on the Paris Accords and kind of thinking again to the next one in England, I guess, is that a lot of people are realizing that we are way off the targets for COP21. And so now people are beginning to say, okay, well, I didn't do that, but I'm gonna really double down this time. Do you have faith that that's possible? Or, you know, people keep talking about, you know, yeah, I'm gonna set these targets for 2050 and step over, you know, the ability to do good in 2025. I mean, we tend to say that, perfect is the enemy of good. There are so many things that we could achieve now that, you know, we're not seeming to implement. Do you have concerns about that, or do you feel like we are on the right path?
So just to repeat back, do I have concerns that countries won't meet their Paris goals? Is that the main question?
That they'll just keep pushing out targets, not meeting them, then pushing them out a little further, and all of a sudden we'll find ourselves here we are in 2040 and we've really not made much progress.
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely concerned about that. I think everyone is right to be. There's a lot of work that has to be done. However, I think targets are good because then, you know, people in the public sector can hold the powers that be accountable to what they said they would do. So I'm not against targets. I think it's good to set bold targets and then you have a path to work toward. I also think that there is more movement here. When you see China coming out with its commitment to achieve carbon neutrality, also Japan, also South Korea, all this year making those commitments. That trickles down into the financial markets. It sends signals. It also orients government spending in those companies around innovation and maybe even government procurement. So is that necessarily going to get us to the Paris goals on time? We will see. It depends on the pace and the scale, but the transitions are happening. And I think this year might actually prove to be a tipping point. The coronavirus pandemic caused some disruptions in markets that I think we could see governments come out of in new ways. Things like green stimulus, right? Rebooting their economies in a lower carbon way could help accelerate, you know, some of the goals here, meeting some of the goals. So I'm optimistic. I think that, you know, we need to be critical and look at the data and see where we truly are. My understanding is we saw an 8% decline in emissions this year because of coronavirus. We had to achieve an 8% emissions reductions every year till 2050 or so. And right. We want to do it without shutting down our economies. So it's a huge task, but I think it is possible, and the scale and the commitments that we're seeing are putting us on the right track.
That's great. One of my favorite things we get to do with our guests is we hand you the magic wand. It's a powerful wand. You can use that wand to do anything you want to do as long as it's for the climate. You can even act like you're the president if you want. So we give you this wand. What would you change, or what would you have done differently that will dramatically improve our ability as we move towards a low carbon future? What's the one thing you do with that wand?
I wish there was a way to massively aggregate everyone's needs on a local level, kind of as I alluded to before, to make sure that whatever we do, whatever happens going forward, really serves the people and benefits their lives and livelihoods and their health. Because I feel like we get caught up in these modeling exercises and political positioning, but what do the people really want? I don't know. I became a journalist because that's what I wanted to do, was really speak on behalf, not on behalf of, I wanted to help give information to people so they can make better choices in their lives. So I wish that there was a way that we could craft our solutions in the climate and energy space that really put people's well-being first. Not everyone's going to be Jeff Bezos, but how do we make sure that people's livelihoods are guaranteed, that their health is improved in time? So I don't have a single metric for that, but I think there are smart policy solutions out there. But that would be my number one priority if I were a leader of the world, is how do we really make a human-centric solution happen here?
Yeah, great, great point. I mean, in fact, we don't talk about it often, but clearly one solution does not fit all. You know, I would argue that your community of LA has a completely different need and solution set than where you grew up. I mean, I'll pick Saskatoon just because I can kind of see that completely different environment, a different way to use energy, a different way to change climate in those two communities. One size doesn't fit all, does it?
No. And I mean, timing is also a factor. Like, there's some communities that may want to change something sooner and others see it implemented and want to follow along. So I think there's shared lessons learned there. But yeah, I think there's something to be said for finding solutions that work for people and emboldening people at a local level to make decisions. And that gets back to the justice point. When you have, you know, people of color making decisions for their own communities, they usually come up with ones that serve them better. So how do you empower those voices and make sure that they can be part of the discussion?
That's an awesome response. And I don't always say this, but I hope your wish comes true. That's a great wish. I just love to ask, because I find, you know, people like you who really think about these issues, you are invested in it. Do you see any role? I'll start by saying propane or natural gas, but I really would love to kind of bring it specifically more to propane. You have, as you see it today, any role you see for those clean, low carbon fuels like propane or natural gas?
I think it all comes down to having an honest discussion about the life cycle effects, right? I use propane. I mean, I have a barbecue. I have a heater in my backyard. I like doing it. At the same time, I'm working on electrifying my home, but propane happens to be the one fuel I'll probably keep around just because I use it outside, etc. So I think there are roles for these fuels. I think we just have to be careful about, again, what is happening on a life cycle basis, because, you know, we're now getting data from satellites that shows the methane leakage issue for natural gas. And so if we try to avoid that, I think we're going to end up in a really scary place climate-wise. But if we can address that in a truly effective way, it might be a different discussion. So I just think we have to get all the information on the table and have an honest look at where we're at and what we need to do to make these resources truly more sustainable.
Yeah. We've had interesting. I did it in Toronto. The electric grid in Toronto is really clean. I was actually shocked about how clean it is in Toronto. Yeah. And you know, we've done interviews all over the country about outdoor living and using heaters to use for restaurants. And of course, people say, what are the environmental impacts? I'm like, well, you know, none of us would choose to heat the outdoors if we had a choice, right? I mean, there's never a scenario where heating the outdoors is an environmentally friendly choice.
Right. But in a pandemic, you may just do that anyway, so you can spend time outside.
Well, yeah, yeah. I said, you know, so we're doing it for other great things, but yeah, and I think we agree that propane seems to have a great role in outdoor living. You know, Maricopa County outside of Arizona, they outlaw wood because they just could not handle any more of that particle matter pollution. It really wasn't about CO2, but it should have been. But so they outlaw wood burning fireplaces, but they allow propane and natural gas fireplaces, and the air quality mm-hmm. cleaned up immediately. It's kind of a cool story.
Yeah. That's the thing, is that it also depends on whether we're talking about local air pollution or climate, and they have different considerations there.
I mean, I agree. Southern California, I'm always fascinated that they're not more interested in health than they are in climate, because there, man, smog, asthma, I'm shocked at the volume of people that are, you know, really sick.
It's definitely a problem. And I mean, they are taking steps, things like electrifying the ports. Like, people forget that Southern California ships some enormous amount of all the goods used across the country. That's partially why, you know, it's a transportation question. So I think they're taking steps in the right direction, but definitely a long way still to go.
So that's a good example where we do fill in. In fact, Long Beach, particularly in the Port of LA, people don't realize how much propane is used there. So clearly it's about electrifying, but even for the next two or three decades, there just aren't enough electrons. So there, it's about propane. And really, we may be on the verge of doing some propane to hydrogen stuff, because it's so easily transported and more easily created. So that's what I was talking about, innovation. We have some cool things happening without even going to energy carbon capture, but
yeah,
we'll see it all. It'll all play out over the next 5-10 years, I think.
Can I play journalist and ask you a question? So what are the stats on how propane is better? What would be your case that you would make to...
This is my show. You can't do that.
Me. I'm hijacking your show, podcaster to another.
No, I mean, I think it's a great, fair question, and it's actually an easy answer, because I'm quick to say, I don't think the issue is about fossil fuels. I don't think all fuels are binary. They're not all clean and they're not all dirty. Certainly I am leading the charge to move away from coal and oil and wood to a degree. But I certainly see a strong role for propane and natural gas as we move towards clean. And I'm not even prepared yet to seed whether that is a transitional fuel or whether that is a fuel of the future as well, because I'll let innovation determine. But certainly, anytime you can use propane or natural gas to replace diesel fuel, to replace gasoline, then you have made a major step forward. In fact, a lot of that reduction you quote in the climate comes as much as we're replacing coal-fired power with natural gas-fired power, right?
There's still a lot of energy in the country that comes from coal. But we did see a 30% decline in its usage in the first half of this year, which is stunning. Yeah. So we're in the midst of the transition.
Yeah, and to your point, I think that's where we are. We advocate for clean, right? I even try not to advocate for propane just because I'm involved with the propane. I'm really trying to advocate for clean. I don't see a future for coal. I don't really see a future for oil other mm-hmm. than it's just sheer domination of the world, you know, to this point.
Yeah. Well, the last thing I'll say, just for, because it came up in that podcast I mentioned that we're producing called Ditched on the financial sector. Mm-hmm. We are seeing a change in tone coming from the financial world around natural gas, in that they are including that in their divestment policies because of the methane issue. Because if you just look at CO2, that doesn't tell the whole story. You have to look at timelines and what gas has an impact on the atmosphere when.
Yeah.
It gets complicated, but I think you are seeing pressure coming from the activists on that side, and some financial players are responding. I don't know how that's going to play out, but it is a theme we saw emerge this year.
Yeah, completely. I mean, I see it too. And by the way, I don't ever talk about it. While natural gas and propane usually are considered very similar, when it comes to unburned methane and propane, we are vastly different. The global warming potential of propane is 4. Really, it's arguably next best to nothing. And that's why if you go to Lidl this weekend or Target or anywhere else you would go, all of their refrigeration cases are made generally today using propane as a refrigerant, because unburned propane is actually quite elegant in the atmosphere as opposed to natural gas, which is quite reactive as a greenhouse gas. We don't ever talk about it because in the aggregate, it's not enough use to get exciting, but it is interesting that that little molecule is not reactive. But I'm the first one to say Exxon, Chevron, BP, they need to clean up these methane leaks. As a guy who's been around drilling, you know, they're just, it's not acceptable, period. So another fun thing we do when we started the Path to Zero, we started planting a virtual national forest. We call it the Propane National Forest. And we use it to thank guests for appearing on this show, and we plant a tree there in your name. You get to pick the forest, and then we do the rest of the work. You're a native you're not a native Californian, but I know you live there now. And so we like to think about a couple forests, the Sierra National Forest or the El Dorado National Forest, but you really get to pick. You got a favorite?
Right. Well, assuming I can't pick a Canadian forest since I am from there, but you know, I'll go with my current home city. Well, the other twist I would put in is if it was possible to invest in a tree within the city core, that would be my favorite thing, because there's actually an injustice around access to shade in our city. And so if there's a way to do that, that would be fantastic. But if we're going with national forests, I would pick the San Bernardino National Forest since it's the one closest to me.
Actually, you make a great point. So we will work on your wish. About something we work with often about urban areas as we think about how to give better transportation, but I'm well aware of kind of the need for creating shade and walkable, you know, environments and everything else that you can do. So we'll work on that. That's a great suggestion, and I thank you for making it.
Great.
So Julia, give us one more, give our listeners a chance, plug your own podcast, if you will, Political Climate. Where can they find out about it?
Yeah, so Political Climate is on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, all the podcasting players. Just search for Political Climate. We're also distributed on Green Tech Media and the independent environmental news site, Our Daily Planet. And they are hosting our series, Ditched. So for the past few weeks, we've been publishing two shows a week so that we could shine a light on the finance sector and how they're moving money into and out of fossil fuels and green solutions. So really looking at, you know, stripping out the policy a little bit and just what are the money players doing in this space. So would love to give a plug for that. We may be taking a little bit of a hiatus in the new year, but we have tons of content that I hope people go check out and is super evergreen. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to share that.
It has been great having you today on Path to Zero. Thanks for joining us.
Of course. Thank you.
To all of you, thank you so much for listening. Appreciate you joining us on the Path to Zero.
This has been Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins. Subscribe and learn more at cleanamericanenergy.us. And if you like what you have heard, rate us on whatever platform you use to listen to your podcast.